The Forbidden City opened from within, China in the 17th century. At the dawn of the 17th century, Europe was at the height of the Renaissance. Shakespeare was writing plays for the Globe Theatre, Rembrandt was about to be born, and Galileo and Kepler were entering their prime. All this, and yet no kingdom in Europe or anywhere else could compare with China, home to 130 million people, the world's largest economy, and what historian Jonathan Spence called the most sophisticated of all the unified realms on Earth. At the center of a carefully nurtured and balanced bureaucracy within the walls of the Forbidden City sat the emperor. His political power had for generations been anchored in the economic clout of upper-class landowners, many of whose offspring served in the emperor's bureaucracy. This may sound like a typical aristocratic system, but China was different from Europe in that there were few inherited titles, and society lacked the heightened sense of class cohesion found in the West. In a system where land ownership was uncertain, necessity called for groups from one level to work for others, but in a relationship that was typically seen to be without exploitation and consequent dissatisfaction. Nonetheless, by the middle of the century, the centuries-old Ming Dynasty found itself sitting atop a powder keg of social instability. Two centuries earlier, before Europe's self-defined Age of Exploration, Ming rulers had sent their fleets around the world, reaching India, Indonesia, Arabia, Africa, and, according to some theories, the Americas. The great admiral who oversaw this exploration was Zheng He. Europe had nothing like Zheng's massive ships. They reached 440 feet in length and could carry up to 500 men. And nothing like Zheng, a Muslim eunuch. Yet soon after his remarkable voyages ended in 1433, the emperor issued an edict banning the construction of ocean-going vessels. Once again, China was bedeviled by Mongol invasions in the north, and to the south, a military foray into Vietnam was not going well. Buoyed by the general belief that China was superior to the rest of the world, elite opinion turned against trade and foreign contact altogether. The conservatism and general complacency of Chinese elites had a chilling effect. The ossified and centralized structure of society discouraged entrepreneurship and independent thinking, and the country grew gradually weaker as a result. By the time of the Ming Emperor Wanli, 1572 to 1620, China's politics had grown increasingly factional, while the weakened economy made it difficult for the central government to distribute aid or support to the countryside, adding to discontent in rural areas. Wanli was in the midst of a decline of his own. Once a conscientious monarch, by the 1580s he had become frustrated over spats with his bureaucrats about which of his sons should be named heir, over where and when he should be allowed to travel, and by debates among his court over ideological issues. He disconnected. He would go for years without holding audiences or addressing crucial issues. Considering the emperor's required role as kingpin of the state, writes the historian John King Fairbank, this personal rebellion against the bureaucracy was not only bankruptcy, but treason. As a result of Wanli's burnout, his coterie of eunuch advisors and the bureaucrats who had access to him gained power. This is a common phenomenon. When a leader withdraws, is ill, or even just whispers, those around him gain his power. For more on this, see Reichard Kapuscinski's The Emperor, in which he describes how during court audiences, Ethiopia's Haile Selassie would listen to entreaties and then whisper instructions to an aide who wrote them down. This individual, known as the Minister of the Pen, was seen to be hugely powerful, as he was the only one who heard the emperor and had his full authority. The eunuchs took advantage of the situation, charging fees for taking messages to Wanli, assuming the right to collect taxes, and even using military guards to impose their will. Disgrace and damage to the emperor were inevitable. Foreign raiders from the north and from Japan noticed and exploited Beijing's weakness. Resources became further diverted to pay off the Mongols so they would cease their attacks. Famines spread. And in Manchuria, a chieftain named Nurhaci, leader of a group of Jurchen tribesmen, saw a moment of great opportunity. Creator of the banner system, which divided his people into different banners and served as a useful organizing principle, Nurhaci cultivated both his economy and his knowledge of Mings. He and his people were very organized and could manage both complex military campaigns and the well-being of society when it was not at war. Seeking legitimacy, Nurhaci declared the foundation of his King Pure dynasty in 1616. Around the same time, he identified 7 key grievances with the Ming leadership, effectively formalizing his conflict with the power in the Forbidden City. Within the next decade before his death in 1626, he had captured more than 70 cities in northern China, and his heirs were waging successful campaigns in Korea and Mongolia, enticing Ming generals to join their ranks and steadily gaining power at the expense of Beijing. The Ming response was bumbling. In an effort to divert resources to pay for troops, they cut back their bureaucracy in the northwest, a region that seemed safe. As a result, they were unable to collect taxes, and their fiscal crisis worsened. Laid-off bureaucrats were also angered and took some mutinous action, such as Li Zaisheng, who in 1630 led thousands of young men in a violent spree across central and northern China. At the same time, plague was decimating villages throughout the country. As emperor, Wanli's grandson Shang Zhen attempted to reverse the problems and reassert control over the bureaucracy, but years of factional fighting and financial problems made it impossible. In 1644, Li Zaisheng mounted a massive assault on Beijing and enjoyed considerable success, largely because he exploited anger at the Ming regime. In fact, when he entered Beijing in April, he did so through gates that were opened from the inside. Abandoned by his ministers and his people, Shang Zhen hanged himself from a tree in the imperial garden, thus ending a dynasty that had ruled China since 1368. Soon after Shang Zhen's suicide, Nurhaci and the Manchus seized Beijing and spent the next generation cementing control of the country. Once they had done so, they ruled for almost 3 centuries, in large part because they were able to appeal to both the disaffected masses and the equally alienated elites within the sprawling but respected Chinese bureaucracy. Jonathan Spence writes in The Search for Modern China that while Nurhaci was alive, he would take over the charitable functions of the ideal ruler that had so obviously been neglected by Wan Li in his waning years, saying that he would never let the rich accumulate their grain and have it rot away, but would nourish the begging poor. Nurhaci also gave important posts to former members of the elite, recognizing that the power of the institution of emperor depended on his ability to operate the networks within it. His son, Huang Taiji, and grandson, Shun Ji, continued the tradition, helping consolidate the empire under the kings. The 6-decade-long rule of Emperor Kangxi, the great-grandson of Nurhaci, oversaw a return to stability in a largely united China. According to the historian Emmanuel Su, Kangxi approached the ideal. He was intelligent, understanding, lenient, diligent, conscientious, and attentive to state affairs. It was under Kangxi that the insecure Manchu rule was turned into a stable and prosperous state. Other accounts concur. In many respects, Kangxi became the first Chinese emperor since the era of Zhang He to constructively re-engage with the world. He led the conquest of 3 southern regions that had been ruled by Chinese defectors, captured Taiwan, and, in the face of the threat of conflict in the north, negotiated China's first treaty with a foreign power, the Treaty of Nerchinsk, which set the boundaries with Russia in much the same position they are found today. At home, he traveled widely, cut taxes, and patronized both the arts and education. To build support with his Manchu base, he respected Manchu religious practices and replaced eunuchs with Manchu leaders. To foster allegiance among the Han, he invoked Confucian values as a foundation of his rule and the kingdom. With typical shrewdness, he created a new system of exams to give the 50 wisest applicants a special degree and then assigned them to write a history of the Ming Dynasty, thus demonstrating deference to those his family had conquered. In short, Kangxi finished the work that Nurhaci had begun 100 years earlier and achieved what Spence calls a depth and extent of power matched by only a few rulers in times of China's earlier greatness. Again, the lessons resonate. Complacency is fatal for elites. Neglect of power is as corrosive as abuse of power. By even the 15th century, disconnecting from the world at large carried a high price. And again, popular unrest has paved the way for one elite to unseat another. Nothing succeeds like good governance. Robber barons or inventors of modernity, America after the Civil War. Had they been Tyrian traders of the year B.C. 1000, landing from a galley fresh from Gibraltar, they could hardly have been stranger on the shore of a world so changed from what it had been 10 years before, wrote Henry Adams on his family's homecoming to the United States in 1868 after 10 years overseas. As Adams observed, the Civil War had transformed America. The economy burgeoned, growing from a real GDP of $72 billion in 1860 to almost $170 billion 20 years later. 2 decades after that, America's GDP was flirting with $400 billion. It would be over a century before such growth would be approached again, with the rapid rise of China and Asia's tigers in the late 20th century. The war effort had produced an industrial bonanza in the North that resulted in a remaking of the rosters of the country's richest. The term millionaire, although in use since the late 18th century, was popularized in the United States in the 1840s, when the richest Americans boasted fortunes in the range of $10 million to $20 million. By the 1880s and 90s, the wealthiest had built fortunes in the hundreds of millions, and by 1892, there were more than 4,000 millionaires identified in the United States. While the middle 60% of the population enjoyed unprecedented social mobility, the poorest quintile remained fairly stagnant, and the richest simply got much, much richer. Commenting on the opportunities offered by the war economy, railroad and banking mogul Daniel Drew observed, "It's good fishing in troubled waters." Theirs was a time of great upheaval. The first total war, the world-changing inventions of the Industrial Revolution, and the integration of the American economy. The tycoons of the Gilded Age were also unfettered by institutions that might have regulated the rough-and-tumble business that brought so much wealth to the fortunate few. The emergence of a class with such extreme wealth produced political backlash and led to the rise of reform groups like Grangers, Greenbacks, and populists. Drawing on the century's most radical big idea, it also produced the notion of social Darwinism, which suggested that growing inequality was inevitable. It implied that successful business people were somehow more highly evolved than the less successful. While the theory is now seen as antiquated and more than a little ugly in its implications, many historians hold that the business titans of that era were, while perhaps not more advanced in their evolution, at least more complex than simplistic descriptions and denigrating titles like robber baron would suggest. To some, students of economic history in particular, these individuals were reformers and innovators, ushering in a period of great growth through applied creativity. The business historian Maury Klein writes, Although no group of people has done more to shape and change every aspect of American life since 1850 than the great entrepreneurs, no group is less understood or more defined by clichés. Sketches of two of the era's most prominent business leaders will almost certainly do more than broad overviews to illustrate the period's contradictory elements and the degree to which many are so relevant today. Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller are real forebears of today's superclass in ways that are considerably more direct and easier to see than, say, Pericles or Kangxi, though I would argue both are somewhere in the DNA of the current group. Andrew Carnegie, Conflicted King of Steel. The father of the steel industry, Andrew Carnegie worked hard to ensure that he was remembered well. He was the model of the conscientious industrialist, preaching as he gave away much of his fortune in his lifetime, "The man who dies thus rich dies disgraced." Yet Carnegie was not precisely what he seemed to be to the public. While a champion of a just society and unfettered individual initiative, and a noted philanthropist, he also embraced a social Darwinist view that justified his wealth and the struggles of those who worked for him. He fancied himself a hero of the working man, but tacitly approved one of the most violent attacks on strikers in American history, in which more than 100 were injured and 13 killed. He gave away hundreds of millions, but slashed workers' salaries, offering to many just the barest necessities of life. In the parts of Pittsburgh he built, there was little plumbing and no paved roads. On his watch, according to one biographer, 1/5 of all Pittsburgh men, most in the prime of their life, died due to accidents. A large majority were in the iron, steel, railroad, and construction industries, and the rate was probably even higher, as many accidents went unreported. Thousands died of typhoid from drinking water from polluted rivers. Homestead, the site of his most advanced iron works, was described as hell with the hatches on. Arriving in America from Scotland at the age of 14, Carnegie got his start as a telegrapher, an entry-level participant in the communications revolution of his age. Soon after, he was hired as the personal telegrapher of Thomas Scott, the Pennsylvania Railroad's general superintendent, who recognized considerable qualities of intelligence and industry in Carnegie, and, soon after getting to know him, invited him to be a partner in an investment in the Woodruff Sleeping Car Company. Admittedly, the company supplied sleeping cars to the Pennsylvania Railroad, and thus a considerable conflict of interest was involved. But this also ensured success, and Carnegie's initial fortune was made. "Blessed be the man who invented sleep," Carnegie later said. When Scott was promoted to vice president of the railroad, young Carnegie, only 24 years old, was promoted to superintendent of the railroad's western division. From there, Carnegie reinvested his sleeping car proceeds in a new industry built up around the discovery of rock oil in western Pennsylvania. He did so well that he soon resigned the railroad job and focused on his own enterprises, which included paying $500 to hire someone to fight in his place in the Civil War, a common practice among the wealthy. Thereafter, he moved into a series of investments in railroad bridge construction, iron production, and the telegraph business before finally settling on steel. He later wrote in his autobiography that he had decided to put all good eggs in one basket and then watch that basket, adding, "I believe the true road to preeminent success in any line is to make yourself master in that line. The men who have succeeded are men who have chosen one line and stuck to it." Carnegie embraced the most modern steel production techniques, focusing on scientific innovation and readying the industry for the kind of mass production that could meet the demands of a rapidly growing U.S. economy. He began to integrate his company vertically along the entire supply chain, buying coke, coal, ore producers, railroads, shipping lines, and a variety of mills. Through such a strategy, he was able to manage costs much more effectively and compete in ways that less integrated competitors could not. He sought to dominate and crush competitors. He was brutally demanding of his workers and seldom gave them much beyond further encouragement to work harder. By 1899, Carnegie Steel was the largest steel company in the world, with total production equal to half that of Great Britain, and supplying one quarter of America's steel. Recognizing the value of friends in high political places, Carnegie supported politicians such as James Blaine, who ran unsuccessfully for president and later became Secretary of State, and Benjamin Harrison, who was elected president in 1889 and rewarded Carnegie by appointing his lawyer to the Supreme Court. The lawyer, George Shiras, was confirmed in a week, even though he had neither judicial nor political experience, the only Supreme Court justice to be so unqualified. Lack of qualifications did not stop Shiras from being a friend of industry, however. In U.S. v. E.C. Knight, he voted that the American Sugar Refining Company had not violated the Sherman Antitrust Act, even though it controlled 90% of its industry. Later, he cast the deciding vote declaring the income tax unconstitutional, and soon after upheld an injunction sought by the government to break a strike at the Pullman Company. Carnegie became a confidant of Harrison. And it may or may not be a coincidence that even though the president signed the Sherman Antitrust Act into law, his administration prosecuted only one case during his tenure. In March 1901, Carnegie retired, selling his company to J.P. Morgan for $480 million. With this asset and several others, Morgan created U.S. Steel, the first company with a capitalization over $1 billion. Its capital, then amounting to 7% of America's GDP, was twice that of the capital stock for all the national banks in the country. Through its subsidiaries, U.S. Steel employed more people than lived in the entire state of Maryland and controlled two-thirds of the steel market. Meanwhile, Carnegie's attention turned to philanthropy, where he set a standard for generosity that exceeded the ruthlessness he had shown in business. He gave away $350 million in his lifetime, and his major trusts and foundations remain active today, including the Carnegie Trust for the Universities of Scotland, the Carnegie Dunfermline Trust, the Carnegie Institute, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where I am a visiting scholar and where I did the work on this book, the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission, the Carnegie Institution of Washington, and the Carnegie Corporation. He is also responsible for building more than 2,500 libraries throughout the English-speaking world. Carnegie's record of philanthropic generosity is remarkable and stands in stark contrast to his unwillingness to share any of his gains with his employees. Though he wrote passionately about the right to form unions, he forced workers at one of his plants to renounce unionization in writing. While families in Pittsburgh had to earn $600 a year to stay out of debt, he paid many of his employees less than $400 annually. The lowest workers made $300, almost 10,000 times less than Carnegie. "It is a waste of time to criticize the inevitable gap between the classes," he wrote in an essay titled Wealth in 1889. According to his social Darwinist views, the concentration of riches among the few resulted from the unequal distribution of talent. In that same essay, he went on to write that wealth passing through the hands of the few can be made a much more potent force for the elevation of our race than if distributed in small sums through wages to the people themselves. He suggested that higher salaries would have been wasted in the indulgence of appetite, some of it in excess, and it may be doubted whether even the part put to the best use, that of adding to the comforts of the home, would have yielded the results for the race as a race. In his autobiography, written after his retirement, he exhibited an about-face. "If I returned to business tomorrow, fear of labor troubles would not enter my mind. but tenderness for poor and sometimes misguided, though well-meaning laborers, would fill my heart and soften it. Is it a contradiction that the brutally competitive, like Carnegie or Bill Gates, who crushed competitors like bugs, might then become so intently and productively philanthropic? Or is their embrace of charity just another way of exercising power and ensuring their legacy with a clear conscience? Carnegie's success as a donor certainly helped offset the reputation he might have had as a result of his tough business tactics. He approached giving systematically, identifying a hierarchy of worthy investments and ranking them from highest to lowest priority: universities, libraries, hospitals and laboratories, parks, music halls, public baths, and finally churches. Not only did others appreciate this commitment, so apparently did he. At the opening of the Carnegie Library in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, attended by Carnegie's friend Benjamin Harrison, Carnegie offered a moving tribute to himself. "The poorest citizen, the poorest man, the poorest woman that toils from morn till night for a livelihood, as, thank heaven, I had to do in my early days, as he walks this hall, as he reads the books from the alcoves, as he listens to the organ and admires works of art in this gallery equally with the millionaires and the foremost citizen, I want him to exclaim in his heart, 'Behold, all this is mine.'" Others were less impressed. "We'd rather they hadn't cut our wages and let us spend the money for ourselves," steelworkers told a Pittsburgh newspaper. "What use has a man who works 12 hours a day for a library anyway?" John D. Rockefeller, the true embodiment of his age. Thin, aloof, pious, John D. Rockefeller looked like a parody of the bloodless businessman. But in many respects, he was the singular author of the modern era. No other American has created a greater fortune. In constant dollar terms, his was the greatest of all time. His business was oil. In The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, Daniel Yergin explains that Rockefeller's Standard Oil operated according to the merciless methods and unbridled lust of late 19th century capitalism. Yet it also opened a new era, for it developed into one of the world's first and biggest multinational corporations. Simply put, Rockefeller was the single most important figure in shaping the oil industry. Ron Chernow, the author of a magnificent biography of Rockefeller, notes, "By creating new industrial forms, Rockefeller left his stamp on an age that lauded inventors, not administrators." His multinational corporation became a model that literally would transform the world. Sensing a void in Gilded Age America, Rockefeller helped create a new economic order. Where the government failed to regulate industries effectively, he grew so large that he regulated them himself. Before federal incorporation laws, Standard Oil, a national company from the start, had to contend with a mishmash of state laws that hampered business and invited corruption. But Rockefeller was inspired to find a way ahead that created a new kind of company. And when that company grew so large that the Supreme Court mandated its breakup in 1911, he was hardly defeated. The component parts of the Standard Oil empire grew independently to be even more valuable, increasing his wealth to $900 million. Chernow writes, "More than anyone else, Rockefeller incarnated the capitalist revolution that followed the Civil War and transformed American life. He embodied all its virtues of thrift, self-reliance, hard work, and unflagging enterprise. Yet, as someone who flouted government and rode roughshod over competitors, he also personified many of its most egregious vices. As a result, his career became the focal point for a debate about the proper role of government in the economy that has lasted until the present day." Rockefeller and a group of partners started an oil refining enterprise when he was only 24. From the beginning, he wanted to expand the company, but his partners were more cautious, and in order to pursue his vision, Rockefeller bought them out. The early days of the oil business were full of startups and small operations. The costs of entry were low, and Rockefeller saw an opportunity to step in and dominate. Within 4 years, with his like-minded partner Henry Flagler, he began to build a company that could subdue any competition. In 1870, the two established Standard Oil, a joint stock company that would enable them to raise the kind of capital they needed to expand, increase efficiency, and thus enhance profits. The company got its name from the commitment that Rockefeller made to produce a standardized and consistent product, an important development in a day and age when inconsistent production of kerosene resulted in 5,000 to 6,000 fatal accidents a year. Flagler used Standard's increasing size to negotiate preferential freight rates with the railroads. This was the kind of not quite legal advantage that larger companies enjoyed before such practices were eliminated with the Interstate Commerce Act and the 1903 Elkins Act. 1 year after starting Standard, the company launched the South Improvement Company, SIC, a cartel of the region's largest refineries. Not only did this group enjoy freight rebates, but railroads also agreed to pay Standard a fee every time they transported crude from non-member refineries. As a consequence, the more competitors produced, the more SIC would make. The historian John T. Flynn dubbed this drawback scheme an instrument of competitive cruelty unparalleled in history. But given the competition among railways, the Rockefeller approach had the advantage of ensuring traffic to all. He promised to become the industry's official umpire, thus solving major challenges for both the oil and the rail industries in one stroke. When the plan was discovered, it produced a chorus of protest and had to be abandoned. But while it worked, Standard and the railroads benefited greatly. In the wake of the SIC setback, Rockefeller embarked on an acquisition initiative. From 1872 to 1879, Standard bought refineries in a pattern that involved making reasonable offers for available properties and, if the offers were not accepted, undercutting the prices of the resistant producers and driving them out of business, or back into Standard's arms. Rockefeller's careful attention to detail and efficiency enabled him to shrewdly undercut competitors. When he discovered that it took 40 drops of solder to seal a can of kerosene, for example, he suggested that they try 38 drops. When a fraction of these cans leaked, he suggested trying 39. This worked and became the new, infinitesimally cheaper Standard. The approach, focusing both on massive scale and on the smallest detail, produced extraordinary results. By 1879, 9 years after Standard was organized, the company controlled 90% of America's refining capacity. With the wisdom of the King Emperors, Rockefeller invited the best managers of companies he acquired to join him at Standard's headquarters at 26 Broadway in Manhattan. Unlike Carnegie, Rockefeller was regarded as an excellent manager. He was comfortable with delegating and committed to building consensus among his directors. His one special quirk was an insistence on secrecy that later would lead the world to wild speculation about what was actually going on behind the plain stone facade of the Lower Manhattan office building. Rockefeller's company did not face the same kind of labor problems that had beset Carnegie. Because Standard became a virtual monopoly so quickly, it ultimately did not face the pressures of competition that often caused price cutting and might negatively affect the ability to pay workers a decent wage. Rockefeller resisted unions but paid above market and introduced the idea of employee stock ownership, declaring, "I would have every man a capitalist, every man, woman, and child. I would have everyone save his earnings, not squander it. Own the industries, own the railroads, own the telegraph lines." Despite this view, Standard's dominance and its practices went too far for some. Investigations and even an indictment for criminal conspiracy were levied against the firm and Rockefeller in 1879. Nonetheless, he continued to work to build efficiencies. When the law prevented Standard from owning companies outside the state of Ohio, Rockefeller named three employees to serve as trustees of out-of-state assets. This maintained appearances even as dividend checks for the trustee-owned companies were passed on to 37 shareholders of Standard, of which Rockefeller was by far the largest. But this was an awkward arrangement, and Rockefeller devised the idea of creating a holding company. It would consist of 9 trustees that would hold shares in each of the state companies owned by Standard. The trust, according to Juergen, made possible the establishment of a central office to coordinate and rationalize the activities of the various operating entities, a task made more urgent by the growing scale of the business. And the trust gave Rockefeller and his associates the shield of legality and the administrative flexibility they needed to operate effectively what had become virtually global properties. The approach was soon copied by companies in a host of other industries, notably many in the agribusiness sector. In response, a movement began among members of the public and political elites to rein in what they saw as overly powerful companies. Indeed, according to the historian Richard Hofstadter, for many Americans, trust busting became a way of life and a creed. The first major legislative initiative to contain the trusts was the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, which specifically sought to end the discriminatory multi-tier pricing of the railroads. The act was full of loopholes, however, and the railroad industry took full advantage of them. 3 years later came the Sherman Antitrust Act, which prohibited trusts and combinations in restraint of trade and threatened serious punishment for violators. The act itself was more a triumph of intention than execution, given its many ambiguities, and companies like Standard hardly paid it any heed. Rockefeller even supported Senator John Sherman's re-election efforts in 1891. The public mood took its toll elsewhere. Ohio successfully sued Standard for violating its state charter as a consequence of transferring control to out-of-state trustees. While this led to the dissolution of the trust in 1892, Rockefeller took advantage of New Jersey laws that now allowed companies to own shares in other firms and created Standard Oil of New Jersey to supplant what had been the Standard Oil Trust. The company's capital increased 1,000%. It quickly acquired holdings in 41 other companies, which in turn controlled numerous others. And so the company had changed its legal clothes, but underneath it was the same giant. John D. Rockefeller remained firmly in control and raked in the profits. Between 1893 and 1901, Rockefeller's share of Standard dividends was approximately $65 million. By 1897, he had shifted some of the management responsibilities to top directors, but he remained the face of the company and was the target of repeated and high-profile investigations and journalistic critiques. For all the fervor of his critics, changes were relatively few and unthreatening to the company until the assassination of the recently re-elected President William McKinley, which opened the door to the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. Like Pericles, the reformer of this era came from the aristocracy, a rich New York State family that could hardly have been expected to become the bane of the moneyed class. Roosevelt was a former crusading New York police commissioner and governor, and a complex character. Hofstadter writes, "He despised the rich, but he feared the poor. While bigness in business frightened the typical middle-class citizen for economic reasons, it frightened Roosevelt for political reasons." Roosevelt was afraid that the growing clout of the trusts and other large corporations might overwhelm that of the elected government. He did not want to do away with large companies, which he saw as inevitable byproducts of national growth. Rather, he felt the government should play a more effective regulatory role. In his first inaugural address, he said, Great corporations exist only because they are created and safeguarded by our institutions. And it is therefore our right and duty to see that they work in harmony with these institutions. And while he was more talk than action for much of his presidency, he not only fueled the progressive fervor in America, but took a number of important steps to address the situation. He established the Department of Commerce, the Department of Labor, and a Bureau of Corporations empowered to investigate companies. He also signed the Pure Food and Drug Act and the Hepburn Act, which strengthened earlier regulations directed at the railroads. Among other moves that resonate today, he sought to prohibit corporations from providing political funds. Many of the initiatives Roosevelt championed were not adopted until the next administration, that of Woodrow Wilson, but the foundational steps he took were indispensable. As for Rockefeller, Roosevelt's government brought suit against Standard Oil in federal court under the Sherman Antitrust Act in November 1906. It was one of 45 antitrust cases prosecuted by his administration. The decision came in 1911 with a majority opinion that read, "We think no disinterested mind can survey the period in question, after Standard's incorporation in 1870, without being irresistibly driven to the conclusion that the very genius for commercial development and organization soon begat an intent and purpose to exclude others." The government gave Standard 6 months to dissolve itself. The pieces became Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, Sohio, which later became the U.S. subsidiary of BP, Amoco, Conoco, Arco, and Sun. In 2006, the collective sales of these successor organizations was $963 billion. If they were still a single corporation, they would equal 3 times the next largest, and their combined sales would exceed the GDP of Russia. Rockefeller lived to be 97. His wealth of $900 million exceeded the U.S. federal budget by $185 million, and at its zenith was equal to 2% of U.S. GDP, 3 times Bill Gates's share today. But, like Carnegie, he gave most of it away, establishing, among other institutions, the University of Chicago, the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, and the Rockefeller Foundation. One grandson, David, became chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank. Another, Nelson, became vice president of the United States. Another, Winthrop, became governor of Arkansas. A great-grandson, Jay, at the time of this writing, serves as senator from West Virginia. Rockefeller's most influential progeny, however, are the companies that succeeded the one he built, and perhaps even more so, the ideas that shaped those companies. Thanks to his unparalleled success, his guiding principles and practices have not only influenced the shape of every multinational corporation on Earth today, but have led to a profound shift in world power structure. His legacies in this regard have included a wide range of contributions, from his collaborative style of management to his centralized ownership but decentralized decision structure, from his focus on consolidation, which he described as cooperation, and his ideas about the vertical integration of enterprises, to his political strategies and views on charitable giving. The actions of the successor companies to Standard Oil in reshaping much of the modern world, leading the exploration for oil in the Middle East, Latin America, the former Soviet Union, and now Africa, have changed the international order, giving once small and secondary nations great influence, even as those companies exerted great influence within and on behalf of those nations. Today, the energy industry is the world's largest and most influential, and the mark of John D. Rockefeller is still squarely on it. More broadly speaking, multinational corporations themselves have risen up to rival nations in economic and political clout, while exceeding countries in their ability to maneuver across borders, much as Standard Oil initially did across state lines in the United States. In a way, these companies have followed the lead of Rockefeller in seeking to stay a step beyond the controls of the regulatory environment, while all the while trying to influence it. The breakup of Standard Oil, in fact, produced a new generation of multinationals that continued to grow out and across borders and dominate the competition, even if they never achieved the complete mastery of a single market that the initial company did when it controlled 90% of the U.S. oil market. At the same time, Rockefeller, like Carnegie, remains a model of the corporate titan who is both an innovator and a symbol of the great disparities of his era. Like the modern CEOs and investors who are his heirs in this regard, he was an example and a lightning rod. In much the same way as we still feel the effects of the democratic innovations of Cleisthenes and Pericles, much as we feel the consequences of the leadership of Nurhaci and Kang Xi and their role in laying the key foundations of today's Chinese ascendancy, we are still grappling with the implications of the changes these giants of the Gilded Age ushered in, and wondering whether, in fact, Theodore Roosevelt's concerns about the relationship between them, their companies, and government were well-founded. Yet his concern takes on a different resonance and greater urgency when companies are multinational and operate in a realm in which government influence is diminished by everything from lack of jurisdiction to the mobility of business organizations. At the same time, as companies grow globally, they also grow in resources and potential influence. So does a concern from an era of trust busting echo even more troublingly today. As we have seen, every era of elites has been marked by overreach on their part and a consequent backlash. The question many are now starting to ask is whether our own time will see the same, whether current efforts to rein in CEO salaries and trim tax advantages for private equity companies are the extent of that backlash, or whether, given the global scope of the activities of current elites, it will take a different form, perhaps a further institutionalization of the reaction against globalization, or perhaps something new, unexpected, more sweeping, and even more disruptive in its implications. To understand the answer to this question, we need to study our own superclass more systematically. Mills's model is useful here, and so in the next four chapters I will do as he did and consider our current elites in clusters: business and financial, political, military, and those who influence through the power of ideas, religious, media, and cultural leaders. Not only does such an approach reveal the differences among these groups, but it also allows us to explore how the global nature of the superclass sets it apart from past generations of elites. It also lets us see how these groups are evolving and consider the implications of that evolution. Nowhere are the changes coming more rapidly than in business and finance, and no group is better adapted to the global nature of the current era. In many ways, these elites have come to dominate and define the superclass, and the successes and challenges associated with it, much as their predecessors, Rockefeller and Carnegie, did their own gilded and divided age. And so, I will begin my examination of the clusters that comprise modern elites by following the money. Chapter 4. The Multinational Moment, when finance and business became the center of it all. To turn $100 into $110 is work. To turn $100 million into $110 million is inevitable. Edgar Bronfman. When I first met Mikhail Khodorkovsky, he was not an oligarch, not the modern Russian equivalent of a 19th-century American robber baron, nor was he a prisoner. In fact, there were no Russian oligarchs back then. The Soviet era had just ended, and Moscow was captivated by a moment of potent and infectious hope, riding a transformational tide that elevated the aspirations of everyone to levels that had been unimaginable only a couple of years earlier. Many of the Russians I met were still somewhat ill at ease with newfound freedoms, however. It was difficult to completely set aside their suspicions, their intuitions about invisible conspiracies, and their enduring certitudes about the value of the right connections. In that sense, it was a perfectly Russian moment, both deeply romantic and laced with something darker. Depending on your taste, Gogol, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, or Pasternak could have captured the mood perfectly. And indeed, each had done so in his own way in different eras. We met for supper in a small, rustic Georgian restaurant in downtown Moscow. The host was Russian journalist Artyom Borovik, who had made his name testing the limits of glasnost as a frontline reporter during the Soviet debacle in Afghanistan. At the time of our meeting, Borovik was the founder and head of a fledgling publishing company called Top Secret. Within a few years, he would be dead, a victim in the crash of a private jet. He had alienated many powerful people, and Russia had become more than a little bit like the Wild West. Laws were followed and enforced only selectively. When crusading journalists died in plane crashes, not only was the immediate assumption that foul play was involved, but no one thought such an assumption was the least bit paranoid. Borovik was excited to introduce me to this quiet young man. Khodorkovsky was a rising star who had become wealthy leading a new post-Soviet banking venture called Menatep. The money for the bank, it was hinted to me, had come from Soviet sources, perhaps KGB sources. But whatever the origins, Khodorkovsky in his late 20s was turning the bank into something remarkable. In retrospect, I half think that Borovik had set up the meeting not just because he was trying to help me develop a network in the new Russia, but because Khodorkovsky was also Jewish. Borovik always seemed acutely aware of my Jewishness and eager to point out and denounce anti-Semitism wherever he saw it. Given Russia's inglorious history in that respect, and the presence of looming nationalist figures like the bombastic Vladimir Zhirinovsky, still touted as a possible president of Russia, and the more subtle but also, according to Borovik, somewhat bigoted General Alexander Lebed, another erstwhile presidential hopeful, such examples were not hard to find. While this sort of ham-fisted pandering was somewhat hard to take, it was well-intentioned, I think. It was also not unusual in my travels. It was a kind of treatment I would also find sometimes in Japan, where business partners would try to bond by catering to my perceived Jewish interests. Borovik and I had arrived to find Khodorkovsky waiting. He was reserved, very young-looking, and for the first 10 or 15 minutes of our meeting, he hardly spoke. But eventually, prodded by our garrulous host, he began to open up about the transformation of Russia and the business opportunities that were being created. What he really wanted to know, though, was whether this American visitor was in a position to help him expand his company, to connect with American bankers and corporate leaders. He felt it was important for new Russian business to become part of the global economic system, and suggested that the failure to do so had helped bring down the old Russian economy. Khodorkovsky had that look that I have seen before in the eyes of the intensely ambitious, a look that marks them long before they have achieved the high visibility associated with their greatest triumphs. It is a look of special intensity, discipline and obsessive attention to detail associated with the monomaniacal focus often required to achieve great success. But Khodorkovsky had something else. He was a little spooky, wanly mysterious. He didn't display much of a sense of humor. He was very guarded about the origins of his business. I sensed he felt that openness was dangerous, that there were enemies out there, and that all serious business had to be conducted in whispers. In this, you could see he was a child of Soviet communism, and maybe a little prescient. For all that, though, it was easy to see in Khodorkovsky and the other Russian business leaders who emerged in the wake of communism's fall traits that are familiar from our brief look at the history of elites, particularly business elites like Rockefeller and Carnegie. At a moment when the new rules weren't clear, Khodorkovsky was taking advantage of the chaos. He had studied at the Mendeleev Institute of Chemical Technology and served as the deputy chief of the Komsomol at the university. There, he was given special opportunity to experiment with creating small business ventures, self-financing in the vernacular of bureaucrats uncomfortable with the language of capitalism. His first effort was a cafe that did not succeed. His next venture was the Foundation of Youth Initiative. Khodorkovsky originally conceived the Foundation of Youth Initiative as a shell under which students of the university could offer their services to enterprises of the state, such as scientific and technological institutes. But Khodorkovsky saw an opportunity within the opportunity. Post-Soviet enterprises dealt in two kinds of money, cash, nalichnya, and a kind of internal currency that could be used only between state-sponsored enterprises, beznalichnya. Despite having the same face value as cash, because of its limited utility, the non-cash was really worth only about a tenth of the currency that could actually be used outside of government channels. Khodorkovsky saw that there was an arbitrage here that could be leveraged to his advantage. In exchange for providing services to state enterprises, the state would transfer non-cash to his account, which he could then convert into cash to be used for the salaries of his young consultants. Of course, he was also able to hold on to significant amounts of it. It was the ultimate money-making scheme, a kind of post-communist philosopher's stone process by which something of little value was turned into gold. Of course, while Khodorkovsky had an important insight, a business innovation well suited to the transformational moment at which Russia found itself, he couldn't have done it alone. Part of his genius, at least at the time, was his cultivation of friends in high places. In his wonderful book, The Oligarchs, David Hoffman offers this insight from Olga Krestyanovskaya, a sociologist who studies Russian elites. The industrial directors who cooperated with Khodorkovsky knew that they were working with the authorities, that it wasn't con artists. In this case, the transaction was a breeze, a simple bank transfer which would have been difficult or impossible if not for Khodorkovsky's good connections. Building on his networks and the easy access to cash, Khodorkovsky made the meteoric rise from capitalist guinea pig to legitimate fat cat in just a few years. After creating Menatep Bank, he served a brief stint as a government advisor, and then, with Menatep and the help of his friends in the government, he engineered the purchase of a vertically integrated oil giant, the second largest in Russia, called Yukos. Yukos proved to be both Khodorkovsky's triumph and his downfall. Rumors swirled that he was able to purchase Yukos only through favoritism, and it was hard to deny the self-dealing involved in the 1995 Russian privatization process. Banks that were awarded oversight of the auction of state assets typically ending up owning those assets themselves, for example. Furthermore, one of his alleged financing innovations with Yukos was his ability to pay for the acquisition of the company through borrowing against its future earnings. But for a man who sought legitimacy, and also for one who had seen the centrality of political control to creating wealth in the new Russia, the siren song of politics was irresistible. Yukos made Khodorkovsky one of Russia's richest men, a billionaire many times over. But once he began to contemplate a future in Russia's political life, he faltered, or rather, he was brought down. He became a threat to the government leadership that he once recognized as central to his success. He overreached, and the questions about his finances provided the pretext for Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, to throw him in jail, which is where he sits today. This cycle, innovation followed by exceptional expansion and accumulation of power, followed by difficulties with the state, was as common among Russia's oligarchs as it was among America's robber barons. Oligarch after oligarch followed it, each taking advantage of the opportunities created by a great moment of historical upheaval. Oligarchs were then co-opted or constrained or intimidated into exile or a reduced role by another elite seeking to establish itself in the name of the masses. A few of Russia's oligarchs have learned to avoid some of the pitfalls that plagued their predecessors. Roman Abramovich, an associate of Boris Berezovsky, another oligarch forced into exile, assumed the reins of much of Berezovsky's empire and built upon them. He quietly acquired large chunks of Russian industrial enterprises, ultimately controlling 80% of Russian oil company Sibneft, 50% of Rusal, the Russian aluminum monopoly, and 26% of Russian national airline Aeroflot. Abramovich, unlike Berezovsky, carefully maintained a low profile for as long as he could, and then, when he could do so no longer, he hired world-class press agents to manage his image in an attempt to avoid the fate of his one-time mentor. He maintained a close relationship with Putin and even serves as governor of a Chukotka territory in Siberia. But perhaps mindful of the lessons of Russia's recent past, he also diversified his assets to include the London-based Chelsea Football Club and vast homes and luxury yachts in the West, and arranged to be able to relocate at a moment's notice should the weather change for him in the volatile environment of Putin's Russia. Like Rockefeller, the Russian oligarchs seized a moment, made the most of it, and then retrenched as government stepped in to constrain them. While Putin seems ascendant today, it is unclear whether his brand of authoritarianism will ultimately triumph or whether it will quash Russia's entrepreneurial spirit and scare away the global investors on whom it depends to tap its enormous resources. What is clear is that in the tug of war between state and business, there has been an ebb and flow. Even with Putin's recidivist impulses, Russia's future depends on its connections with the global economy and the ability of its elites, its growing membership roster among the numbers of the superclass, to maintain a place as an influential force within the country. In some respects, the Russian story of cowboy capitalism, the rise of the oligarchs and the reaction against them, is not just reminiscent of the history of elites past. It is also consistent with similar present-day struggles among business elites and government elites worldwide. The distribution of power has shifted. Business leaders are benefiting from the vitality and opportunities created by globalization. Easy access to capital, to new markets, to the leverage that comes from multiple power sources and bases of operation worldwide. Government leaders are more constrained by the geographically bound nature of their roles, and in some cases are taking draconian steps to try and tip the balance back in their favor through renationalization, tougher regulations, and selective enforcement or creative interpretation of the law. All are seeking new models, new approaches to the relationship between business and government in the global era. The corporate cluster within the superclass. When C. Wright Mills's The Power Elite was published in 1956, he focused on different clusters of elites. Some had to do with social status or with origins of wealth. The chapters carried names like the celebrities and the very rich. Others focused on the nature of the power elites wielded, the chief executives, the corporate rich, the warlords, the military ascendancy, and the political directorate. He emphasized the crossover among these groups and the changes affecting them, changes from what had been historical norms in the United States and earlier in Europe. Writing of the corporate rich, Mills noted a change in which, "Now the corporate seats of the rich contain all the powers and privileges inherent in the institutions of private property." In other words, he acknowledged that the world of mid-century America had moved to a business-centered system not only of wealth, but also of class. The consequences of the Industrial Revolution were becoming clear. Mills marveled at how the chief executives of companies had assumed much of the power that once belonged to the owners. "Are not," he asked, his Marx-influenced views showing more than a little, "the old expropriators now expropriated by their salaried managers?" Like much of America in the post-World War II era, Mills was struck by a changed order in which corporations were assuming an even greater role than in the past, when the real center of gravity of the country was with smaller businesses, the middle class, and, earlier still, with those who owned and worked the land. Mills concluded his look at each elite cluster with a discussion of how power is balanced within society, and how past theories of this balance were in need of revision. Americans cling to the idea that the government is a sort of an automatic machine regulated by the balancing of competing interests. This image of politics is simply a carryover from the official image of the economy. In both, an equilibrium is achieved by the pulling and hauling of many interests, each restrained only by legalistic and amoral interpretations of what the traffic will bear. The ideal of the automatic balance reached its most compelling elaboration in 18th century economic terms. The market is sovereign, and in the magic economy of the small entrepreneur, there is no authoritarian center. And in the political sphere as well, the division, the equilibrium of powers prevails, and hence there is no chance for despotism. The nation which will not adopt an equilibrium of power, John Adams wrote, must adopt a despotism. There is no other alternative. Mills, it is clear, believed that the balance was gone, that the small actors had been succeeded by big actors who often moved in concert, who collaborated to eliminate balance altogether. He lamented that big decisions were taken without public debate, a sentiment easy to understand in the wake of America's decision to enter a war in Iraq without benefit of a congressional declaration of war or any real national deliberation. And when he argued that the middle class, the country's pivot and stabilizer, was becoming increasingly weak, we of the current era, an era in which middle classes have shrunk everywhere in the world but China and India for over a quarter century, again hear unsettling echoes. Such echoes are among the reasons his book retains its relevance today. But what is most striking about Mills's observations is that while they raise important questions about how societies function, they are also anachronistic. He is writing not only about just one country, but also about the results of the epical transition triggered by one event, World War II, and the economic, social, technological, and political trends leading up to it. Indeed, he was measuring the aftermath of the kind of great upheaval that we have seen causes fundamental changes in elite structures. Now, 50 years later, another such epical transformation is taking place with the advent of the global era. Global capital and information flows are already instantaneous, and transportation times and costs have declined markedly. The result makes global enterprises possible, but it also carries their message to diverse audiences, knitting them together. Global branding is an important element of the formation of global culture with companies like Coca-Cola, Microsoft, IBM, GE, Nokia, Toyota, and Intel, all deriving more than $30 billion in estimated value from the international awareness they have built over the years. Furthermore, for most large companies, the greatest growth markets are overseas. In China or India for developed country companies, or in the United States or Europe for the emerging blue chips of China and India. With such developments also comes a need for the big corporates to seek harmonized regulations and standards, so that they don't incur the great costs of customizing products to the needs of individual countries. Thus, the globalization of business produces changes in governments, and the mobility of businesses, their ability to project influence anywhere rapidly and effectively, and their growing resources give them even greater leverage than Mills could ever have imagined when considering the big companies of his era, many of which were rooted in a single nation and had to play by a single set of rules. In addition, not only has the onset of the new era shifted the central story of importance away from the power elite of the world's richest and most powerful single country to that associated with the borderless realm of the global economy, but it also raises many questions about just what clusters of power are important and how their relationships may have changed since Mills's day. One perspective on the nature of that transition was recently offered in what might be considered an unlikely setting, one of Washington's many black tie galas, events that typically serve up little more than gossip and rubbery chicken. It was the annual dinner of the Atlantic Council, a think tank supporting the transatlantic relationships that have been a mainstay of U.S. foreign policy since, well, always. This dinner featured 500 business, government, and military leaders and was held in honor of three current or former superclass members. Steve Schwartzman, who, thanks to the ascendancy of private equity, had become the flavor of the month on Wall Street, was receiving an award for business leadership. General Jim Jones, former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe and former Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, was receiving an award for military achievement. And for government service, the award went to a man who has sat near the apex of the pyramid, a man of the superclass within the superclass, Alan Greenspan, who, for roughly two decades, served as the inscrutable Yoda of global financial markets in his role as chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve. Even after his retirement, Greenspan has proved he can move markets with a well-turned phrase. Introduced by former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who received an adoring reception from the tuxedoed audience, each of the award recipients settled into a chair to participate in a question-and-answer session with a past award winner, former two-time U.S. National Security Advisor General Brent Scowcroft. Scowcroft, who was typically wry and wise while questioning the recipients, turned to Greenspan first. The question probed into the impact of the Atlantic Alliance on Greenspan's work at the Fed, but Greenspan dove deeper, exploring the end of the Cold War as a pivotal moment not only in a geopolitical sense, but also in terms of the global economy. When the Berlin Wall came down to reveal the economic disaster and utter failure of central planning, he said, it was a moment of awakening not only for those directly engaged in the Cold War. Greenspan saw the fall of the USSR and communism not only in terms of the opportunities it opened up within those countries directly affected, as in the case of the rise of the oligarchs, but also as a signal to the emerging world that there was now only one path, to accept the results of the 75-year experiment in comparative political economic philosophy and engage in global markets. The profound potential of this moment was a billion new workers and consumers in the global economy embracing our views. Greenspan spoke of this promise with deep conviction as demonstrating, even in our complex world, the surpassing power of ideas. His comments stood in stark contrast to the much more narrowly focused and practical observations of Schwartzman. The Blackstone CEO spoke of how America was losing its competitiveness because of regulations like the Sarbanes-Oxley provisions that required more detailed disclosure and oversight of corporate finance. He observed that some corporate boards were now spending a third of their time on compliance issues, and that as a consequence, U.S. business leaders were not able to focus on the right issues, the ones associated with building value for shareholders. He also noted that such regulations had resulted in a 90% drop in U.S. initial public offerings because companies that wanted to go public were listing overseas in markets where regulations were looser. He urged the American government officials in the audience to adopt a less intrusive role or the market would simply go elsewhere. And he characterized the rise of private equity companies as a capitalist response to the problems created by a Washington that did not realize the damage their laws were doing to the competitiveness of U.S.-based firms.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.